Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really significant legal puzzle, the Massachusetts case of Commonwealth v. Lycus. This case, it stems from a 1973 murder conviction, and it gives us a powerful look into how courts handle challenges to old convictions when, new scientific information comes to light.
And also when there are questions about what the prosecution should have shared, right? Especially with the FBI involved.
Exactly. You send us a fascinating collection of material on this, a legal reporter's breakdown, a standard case brief, and some background on how we put these deep dives together.
Absolutely. What makes the Lycus case so relevant for you, the listener, especially law students, is how it forces us to think critically about the justice system's ability to grapple with evolving science.
Right, and the fundamental fairness of the whole process, even decades later.
Yeah. Our goal today is to really dissect how the courts evaluate these post-conviction claims based on science that's been, questioned or disproven.
And to clarify the prosecution's duty to disclose evidence, especially when it's held by federal agencies like the FBI.
And ultimately, to understand what hurdles someone actually faces when trying to get a new trial so long after the original verdict, it's a high bar.
Okay, so let's lay the groundwork. Let's look at the original crime and how Edward Lycus ended up convicted back in 73.
It was a terrible case, the 1972 kidnapping and tragic murder of 13-year-old Paul Cavalieri, plus extortion attempts against his father.
And at the trial, the prosecution presented a few key pieces of evidence. What were those?
Right. For you keeping score, the prosecution's case really rested on three main pillars. First, they had voice spectrogram analysis.
Which was cutting-edge stuff back then.
Totally cutting edge, aimed at matching Lycus's voice to the ransom calls. Second, the FBI did this compositional analysis of bullet lead,
CABL, right. Trying to link bullets.
Trying to link ammo from the crime scene to Lycus. And finally, maybe most importantly in hindsight, several lay witnesses, people who actually knew Lycus, testified his voice matched the ransom caller.
So it was a mix. Seemed like really advanced science for the time, plus, more traditional witness testimony.
Exactly. And that led to the conviction in 73. It was upheld on appeal in 1975.
But that wasn't the end of the road for Mr. Lycus, was it?
Not at all. The procedural history here is, well, it's long. Lycus kept fighting. In 89, he had an appeal, got resentenced, but the conviction stood, no new trial.
But then things shifted later on.
Yeah, significantly. In 2008, a motion judge actually granted him a new trial. That was huge.
And why was that? What changed?
It was largely because the FBI hadn't disclosed crucial info to the defense. Specifically, a 1993 FBI report calling the earlier voice analysis inconclusive.
A report the defense had asked for but never got.
Precisely. And on top of that, by 2008, the science behind CABL analysis, that bullet lead stuff, had been seriously questioned. Pretty much discredited, actually.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting for our listeners. You'd think FBI's own report saying inconclusive, the bullet science falling apart, new trial seems likely, right?
You would think, but that's not how it played out. The Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, the SJC, they reversed that decision.
Wow. So the highest court in the state stepped in and said, no new trial.
Exactly. The Commonwealth appealed the motion judge's order, and the SJC sided with them, putting the original conviction back in place. Their reasoning dug deep into several key legal principles.
And those principles are really the core of what law students need to understand from this case.
Absolutely.
So let's dive into those issues. First up, the prosecution's duty to share evidence, especially when it's held by the FBI. This is the Brady rule, right?
Precisely. Brady v. Maryland, the fundamental rule. Prosecution must disclose exculpatory evidence, stuff that could suggest innocence.
But how does that apply when it's the FBI, a federal agency, holding the evidence in a state case?
That was the crucial question. The SJC looked at a quote from one of our sources. A prosecutor's duty extends to exculpatory evidence in the possession of police who participated in the investigation.
Okay, so they're saying if the agency is part of the investigation team.
Then the duty extends. And the SJC said the FBI was absolutely part of the team here. They did the voice analysis, the CABL. The court pointed to the high degree of cooperation and that the FBI knew the defense wanted those lab reports.
So the FBI wasn't just like some outside consultant, they were integral.
Definitely. They were actively generating key evidence for the state.
And the stuff they didn't share, that 93 inconclusive report, The later problems with CABL seems pretty exculpatory on its face.
It certainly seems like it could help the defense. And the SJC did find that not disclosing the 93 voice report was a Brady violation. They broke the rule.
Okay, a violation.
But, and this is the critical distinction for students, they decided the violation wasn't material.
Materiality. Okay, that's the next big concept. What does that mean? How significant does undisclosed evidence have to be?
The standard is whether the suppressed evidence creates a real doubt on the justice of the conviction. It's not just about being helpful. It has to be significant enough that it could have reasonably changed the trial's outcome.
So, like, finding a receipt proving the defendant was elsewhere is material. Finding a minor typo in a police report? Probably not.
Exactly. It has to undermine confidence in the verdict itself.
So how did the SJC justify saying the FBI's own inconclusive voice report wasn't material? That feels like it could have really dented the prosecution's case.
Well, their reasoning had two parts. First, they called the report cumulative,
meaning
Likas's own expert at the original trial had already attacked the reliability of voice spectrograms anyway, so the FBI report backed that up, but it wasn't like a brand new argument.
Okay, so it wasn't totally new information hitting the jury.
Right, and maybe more importantly, the report didn't exclude Likas, it just said inconclusive. They couldn't say for sure either way. It wasn't proof he wasn't the caller.
Oh, okay. It wasn't exoneration, just uncertainty. That makes sense. What about the CABL evidence, though? By 2011, that science was basically punk. Why wasn't that material enough?
This is where the SJC really focused on the totality of the evidence from the original trial. That's key for students. Yes, CABL was discredited, but the court saw it as just one piece, maybe even a minor piece, of the overall case.
They felt the other evidence was strong enough to stand on its own.
Pretty much. They viewed the later discrediting of CABL as not really undermining the strength of the other pieces of the puzzle, in their opinion.
So what were those other stronger pieces? What did the SJC really hang their hat on when they said there was no real doubt?
They kept coming back to the overwhelming circumstantial evidence.
Yeah.
Things like Likas changing his story with investigators.
Inconsistencies in his statements.
Right. And the big one, a significant chunk of the ransom money was found in his possession.
Okay. That's hard to explain away.
Very hard. But maybe the most persuasive thing for the court was, and I quote, "The testimony of seven of his friends who identified his voice as that of the ransom caller independently of FBI analysis."
Seven friends. Wow.
Yeah. As one source put it, add to this the testimony of seven of his friends who identified his voice as that of the ransom caller, and the weight of the case became crushing.
So those lay witness identifications carried enormous weight, maybe even more than the fancy FBI science stuff.
That's a really astute observation. It seems that way, doesn't it? It raises fascinating questions about how courts weigh different types of evidence.
Yeah, like why trust the friend's ears potentially more than the FBI lab, even when the lab's methods were later questioned?
Well, perhaps the court saw the friend's testimony as more direct, less prone to the kind of scientific shifts we saw with voice prints and CABL. These were people saying, "I know that voice."
Even though we know eyewitness or ear witness testimony isn't perfect either.
Absolutely not perfect. But here, the consistency, the number of independent identifications, the SJC found it highly convincing. It definitely makes you think about how we weigh eyewitness accounts today.
Definitely. Now, quickly, there was also an ineffective assistance of counsel claim in here somewhere, right, about the wiretaps.
Yes. Earlier on, Likas argued his trial lawyer messed up by not fighting harder against the wiretap evidence, the recordings that were used for the voice analysis.
But the court didn't buy it.
No. The court called it a reasonable strategic choice by the lawyer at the time. Even though the strategy didn't win, courts give trial lawyers a lot of leeway unless a decision was just, you know, completely unreasonable.
Okay, so stepping back, thinking big picture for law students,
mm-hmm.
This case really highlights some tricky tensions, doesn't it? Like science changes, voice prints, CABL cutting edge then, junk science now, basically.
Yeah, right.
Should that automatically undo old convictions? Where's the line?
That's the million-dollar question. There's a huge societal need for finality in judgments. You can't just reopen every case whenever science takes a step forward.
It would be chaos.
Total chaos. But you also have the fundamental need for justice. If someone's locked up based on evidence we now know is garbage, that feels wrong, even if there was other evidence too.
So how do courts square that circle?
Likas suggests they look at the whole picture. Was the flawed science the main pillar, or just one part? Here, the SJC clearly felt there was enough other strong evidence. The friend's testimony, the money, the inconsistent statements, that even removing the bad science didn't create that real doubt.
It really emphasizes that contrast, again, the lay witnesses versus the expert analysis. The friend's testimony seemed almost bulletproof in the SJC's eyes, even compared to FBI reports.
It's striking, isn't it? Maybe they saw it as more direct, less filtered through scientific interpretation that could later prove wrong. Like, I heard what I heard. Again, it's not foolproof, but in this specific context, it seemed to carry immense weight.
Let's play hypothetical. What if the other evidence was weaker? Like, no ransom money found, fewer inconsistencies in his story. Would the outcome have been different then, you think?
Oh, almost certainly. If the case had really hinged heavily on the voice prints and the CABL without that strong circumstantial backbone and the chorus of friends' voices,
then the later discrediting of that science would have been much more impactful.
Exactly. Then the non-disclosure, the bad science that probably would have created the real doubt needed for a new trial, the strength of the other evidence was key here.
So, boiling it down for the law students listening,
yeah,
what are the big takeaways from Commonwealth v. Likas?
Okay, three main things. First, Brady duty extends to federal agents who are really part of the state's investigative team. Prosecutors can't just plead ignorance about what the FBI has.
Got it. Point one, shared responsibility.
Second, materiality isn't judged in a vacuum. Courts look at the suppressed evidence in context of everything else presented at trial. How much did the jury already hear? How strong was the other evidence?
Point two, context matters for materiality.
And third, getting a new trial based on newly discovered evidence, especially evolving science, is tough. You have to show it probably would have changed the verdict and seriously undermines confidence in the conviction.
Point three, high bar for new trials based on new evidence. No. It really does highlight that balancing act courts perform. Procedural fairness, the right to see the evidence versus finality. Likas shows that even with scientific progress revealing past errors, strong independent evidence can keep that conviction standing.
Precisely. As we said, it balances fairness against finality. It's a constant tension.
So, a final thought to leave our listeners mulling over.
Mm.
Given that science will keep evolving, what should the system do about past convictions that relied heavily on methods we now know are flawed, even if there was other evidence?
Yeah, what mechanism should exist? Is the current materiality standard enough? It's a really complex question, and cases like Likas force us to keep asking it. There are no easy answers.
Yeah.